Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the May 2nd, 2023 edition. Happy International Labor Day yesterday and all days, folks. Back in full swing in their Santa Ana location now is Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development, with the whole roster of community activation, building leaders and guiding prospective clients, and all this under the helm of their executive director, Eli Flores. And in the second segment is Andy Knight, co-director of the South Coast Repertory's 25th Annual Pacific Playwrights Festival, underway. It's really underway because the world premieres are starting now that came out of this festival, and that's underway, but it'll go through May 7th. And it's a South Coast Repertory's outsized role in dramatic arts. We're going to talk about that through this incubation of plays from ideas to final production. So we'll be right back with Ellie. Don't go away. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development, and that will be called OCORD in shorthand from here on. It's a local nonprofit that combines community organizing, civic participation, strategic research, and advocacy to engage residents, workers, and stakeholders in local government decisions that impact economic opportunity, community health, and overall quality of life. Before OCORD, Ellie was a consultant for youth build programs for the U.S. Department of Labor, the California Director of Civic Engagement for National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. He was the founding executive director of LEAD Incorporated. He's racked up extensive experience leading youth and community development programs in local, state, and international settings, including renewable energy and political campaigns. So he's provided the resources and support, partnerships necessary to bring about the change on the community level. He completed training at the Los Angeles Trade Technical College, his Bachelor's of Arts in Organizational Management at Ashford University, and his Master's degree in Social Impact at Claremont Lincoln University. Ellie comes to us today from his office in Santa Ana. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Ellie Flores.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm so glad to have you. I used to be a bit more, you know, a little, have my toe in those citizenship fairs. And listeners, Ellie, they've heard about that a lot from previous coverage with OCORD. But I sort of want to give you a chance to tell a little bit of your story with OCORD starting. If you'd offer just a little background on your appointment, because I'm placing it was in October 2020, that there was a leadership change and a new address at OCORD. There was a chaotic presidency nationally that threw some sand in the gears of green card carriers seeking the pathway to citizenship. There was a messy presidential campaign, and it was a pretty scary stretch of the COVID pandemic. Oh, and one more thing. There's the machinations in Anaheim selling short the asset of the Angel Stadium and surrounding properties, with labor and low-income residents bobbing in the wake. That's when you started on court. Just what was that like, dude?
Yeah, that transition was definitely challenging because I was coming in, you know, as a bit of an outsider, right? Not complete outsider. I had done work in Orange County through the 2020 census work. So part of my work in the Leo Educational Fund was to be able to not just fund the work in Orange County, but be part of the Orange County census table that really helped to drive some of the outreach work out here. So I was familiar with a lot of the organizations. But you know, in October and prior to that, you know, I've had conversations with OCORD. And OCORD was an organization that I really valued throughout the years. I've heard so much work and amazing, you know, campaigns come out of OCORD. And so when I received the opportunity to possibly come over, I definitely was challenging, but I think it was worthwhile because it is important for organizations like Accord to remain in Orange County and to remain open because we're one of the few organizations that really pushes back and challenges, a lot of the issues and the corporate dominance over elections and over community development that we see happening across Orange County. So it's important that the organization is here.
Well, right. And you're dealing with some very vulnerable demographics. And I gave a little bit of nod to them teeing up this question. They are both the ones that are laboring around that inside the Platinum Triangle, where, you know, real estate started getting a little harder for people to live nearby where they work. And I remember the OCORD panel with the voice of OC, the editor, that was warning people there's stuff going to go down with the stadium transaction. And you were, I mean, OCORD was ahead of that and trying to sort of bring everybody along with these are the civic pieces, the obligations of the brand. There's a lot of institutional kind of sharing with the locals about this asset that everybody has a partial ownership in. There's that, and how would it affect them, what to watch for, as well as the other vulnerable population of people that are trying to pursue citizenship. And having been in those fairs and the kind of the interaction with the information you want, what's needed for the N-400, the locals applying for citizenship and the organizations that are at those fairs, that you all know each other well enough that people are assured that this is going to be handled capably for all time. So those institutions are huge that OCORD is in the middle of. And so bringing that up, I'd like to but go back a little bit further back from that, though. But when you were the consultant for the Labor Department, and as I looked at mm-hmm. at the timeline, though, but you were involved a little bit with the former administration and contracting, mm-hmm. then a little bit after. And so I don't know if you have any kinds of observations or tales about that. I mean, you were straddling a very interesting sort of transition there.
Yeah, so I was a consultant for youth bill programs in specific. And so youth bill programs is a federally funded program that reaches the 16 to 24-year-old population that's neither in school nor working. And they utilize the mechanisms of leadership development and workforce development to be able to help these young people reengage back into education, but also prepare them for the workforce. And so I was a consultant to be able to help build the capacity of a lot of these organizations on the ground that are doing the youth development work and specifically working in the high-risk sort of community, high-risk area. And not just here, by the way, I also did consulting in Latin America to support programs that are doing the same thing. So I would say that similar to any other department that goes through administration changes, there's always good people on the inside. There are always people that are committed to the mission of that particular department. In my case, right, the Department of Labor, they are committed to ensuring that Americans have opportunities to be able to get trained, to enter the workforce, to be able to build like solid pathways and pipelines, from communities to workforce and to careers. And so that commitment is there, and that commitment is being driven by the staff. And obviously, administrations come and go, but I think the staff there remain true to what the origin and the mission of the Labor Department is. And I think that is what gave me sort of like solace and the ability to continue working, even though I may have disagreed completely with the administration. In some way, some people might see you and say you are an extension of the administration. But not true. I mean, the administration does set priorities, but the administration does not completely control what the department does. There are amazing career folks there that continue to work throughout all these different administrations. And I would say that that's what I continue to focus on, of what my mission was and what the organizations on the ground were trying to do and trying to help.
Well, I just have to ask, Ellie, if that your involvement with the careerists, if maybe that was reinforcing their own kind of role in what they did for the Department of Labor. And so you had a role in sort of keeping them hanging on in maybe adverse conditions.
Yes, because, you know, the career staff, you know, unfortunately do go through a lot of scrutiny with what they can say or not say out to the public, depending on what the administration desires. And so I think as a consultant, I have a bit more flexibility with what I can talk about or how I feel I can help build the capacity of organizations on the ground that are receiving federal funding. And so I'm able to be a bit more flexible and able to do the work that sometimes a career folks cannot. And I'm brought in because of my experience, right? I'm brought in because I was a formerly incarcerated young person, so I understand a lot of the conditions that young people are going through in these programs. Additionally, I have a professional background, which, you know, gone through not just education, but working in youth development organizations on a local, national, and international level. So I'm able to combine all these things and be able to do the work that a lot of the career folks may not be able to, right? They understand what they do within the department, but sometimes when you relate that to the real world or to the outside world, it doesn't always translate. So you need folks that have the on-the-ground experience to do that, and that's why I was brought in to be able to support the on-the-ground capacity building that needed to take place.
There's our seg, folks, the on-the-ground. So it's an expansive charter that OCORD has. And I remind everybody, you know, Orange County is the fifth largest county in the country. So how do you arrive at your priorities at OCORD now with so much going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that I think organizations can arrive. The way that we decided to arrive to our priorities is by taking first a community approach to this process, you know, what we call and everybody calls the strategic planning process, right? And so we knew that me coming in, we needed to be able to revamp who we are, our values, our mission, our vision, but we wanted community to be at the core of that process. And so I actually engaged in listening sessions with the community. We did interviews with the community as well. We also did a lot of interviews and listening sessions with partners, funders, our staff, our board of directors. So it was an all-encompass like process for us to be able to get to where we are now. And that is the approach that we took, right? There are so many issues that we can tackle.
Right.
There are so many things, right, that come through that process. But we ultimately arrived at like three major areas, then connect to one overarching theme, right? And so I think for us is we arrived at economic justice, which is, you know, ensuring that workers are treated with respect, dignity, and equity, and they have access to training, resources, and opportunities to grow. That's one area. Second area we arrived at was housing justice, to ensuring that housing and neighborhoods are equitably resourced and provided an environment where people can thrive. And then third is community-driven education that is accessible for all. So that's what we call education justice. And for us, all these three things have an overarching thing that we are really challenging and fighting for a government that works for communities and aligns with their needs and the values of residents above the interests of corporations. That's ultimately the place where we arrive at when we think about these three, the intersects of these three issues.
Well, I'm, you know, there's huge organizations including Disneyland in the area. That's like the sort of the apex of corporate kind of power and the interactions. And I'm sure you're glad you're not in Florida with all those added drama which is quite constant. But what are you tracking now, and what are some trends that you want to put on listeners' radars?
Yeah, I think we are one of the organizations that is tracking what is happening in the city of Anaheim very, very closely. I think for your listeners who might not sort of understand the nutshell of what happened in Anaheim, or what's happening is ultimately it's government corruption. And, you know, the ex-mayor of Anaheim was intending to sell the Angel Stadium to the Angels at a very reduced price without community input, and in exchange he would receive, though not him directly, but a political action committee would receive $1 million contribution that would help him ultimately to get reelected as mayor. That opened up the floodgates and doors to FBI investigation, and now an internal investigation that we had to fight for, actually, to continue to get funded, to get completed, right? So I think one of the things that I want to put into the radar of your listeners is that actually today, which is Tuesday, May 2nd, the city of Anaheim, the council, will be voting on whether they want to release a redacted version of the internal investigation or the full version of the internal investigation. And this has been a fight that Accord and other organizations have really taken up, and we're demanding that the city shares and be able to give out the entire unredacted investigation and the findings, because we know, or not we know, but the investigators have indicated that there is additional criminality that might be coming out due to this investigation. So if we want to really challenge corruption and root out corruption in the city of Anaheim, we need to know what that corruption fully is to be able to challenge the city to get rid of that corruption at the root, right? But if we don't know what's really happening, if it's a redacted version that gets put out by the city, then we're never going to really know the truth or the extent of the corruption that is taking place in the city of Anaheim. So I would put that in the radar of your residents, that this is something that is ongoing. There's a vote that will be taking place today, and we will be there to ensure and to try to fight for the unredacted version of this report.
And these are now hybrid meetings, so anybody anywhere in the world, actually, but anywhere in the county can witness, and maybe even, I don't know if it's too late to email if they're not appearing in person. So are you, Ellie, are you applying pressure directly on the council members, or are you directing your energies with Accord affiliates to put the pressure on? Or you're just doing everything because of you wanting the full version?
We're doing both. Yeah, we're doing both. We are mobilizing with our partners in Anaheim, and there's a lot of amazing organizations in Anaheim that are working side by side with us as well. And then we're applying pressure directly on the council, right? And we do that through applying pressure through media, through social media, but then also being present, right? Ensuring that the council knows that they cannot make a decision or take a decision without community knowing about it, because the community will be there, and we will listen and we will speak. And so, yeah, we're applying pressure in those ways. And sometimes these meetings can take a very long time.
Yep.
But we stay through and we continue to apply pressure, and we won't let up until that report is released, so we know the full extent of corruption that may exist in Anaheim.
So I know Jose Moreno is no longer on the city council, but he invariably he invariably must have some receipts, and he can let people know what to look for or what to ask for, to call out, to put the pressure on. I mean, is he still a little bit involved with getting full disclosure?
I don't know the full extent of his involvement, but I would say that we learned a lot from Dr. Moreno and his fight for transparency, but also his fight for elections reform in Anaheim. I think for us there is sort of like a base of where a lot of these issues stem from. And ultimately, like, we believe that money in politics really, really corrupts. And that has been the case in the city of Anaheim. There needs to be stronger protection against the corruptibility of an elected, and then once they're in office, right, the influence that they may be able to have due to the contributions that they receive. And essentially, right, the agendas and the policies are set by folks who contributed the most during the election time and who will possibly contribute in their next election bid. And so Dr. Moreno was a fighter for that, right, to be able to challenge that, to really make elections about what they are supposed to be, which is the people, which is the voter. And that is something that we will continue to also fight for, really in the legacy of Dr. Moreno and his fight. And I believe that I'm sure Dr. Moreno still is paying a lot of attention to what's happening in the city of Anaheim. And we thank him for his leadership throughout the years and his voice that is so missed right now at the council meeting.
Well, he was at that OCORD meeting before all of this, before the transaction was final between the mayor and the Chamber of Commerce and the Angels owner. So that's where I sort of put him in there. But I'm just wondering if people, having consumed the news coverage about the indictment of former Mayor Sidhu, if they thought, okay, we're good now, we can now go on to other things. Are you dealing with a little bit of that kind of people thinking they can rest on those laurels and that they can move on to other things? Or because this is a big lift to get a full version of the council's interactions.
Yeah, we're dealing with a little bit of that, but I would say that there are still organizations on the ground that are doing such amazing work and really trying to maintain and fight for that, fight for the unredacted version and continue to fight. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, the issue is not just about this particular cell of a stadium. It's really deep-seated corruption for many, many years, right?
Right.
And many cycles of elections, right? And so I think for us, it's continuing to talk to community, not just, by the way, on the defensive side, meaning we have to just defend, but we have to start setting goals, I think, for what we want in the future, which is why, you know, I think a lot of our organizations are really contemplating a long-term vision for what we want Anaheim to look like. And part of that is going to start with us doing some research or understanding what are the current conditions that people are living with. Like, if you just simply ask the question to community, you know, is the quality of life better in the 21st century for a resident in Anaheim? Right? If you just ask that question and you try to look at it from a healthcare and economic lens and education lens, you will sort of begin to understand that living conditions are not better today than they were in 2020 for an Anaheim resident that is living in an under-resourced community. They're not much better. In fact, economically, it is harder for a resident to live in Anaheim because it costs more money to live in Anaheim today than it does in 2020, but then the wages have not kept up with the standard of living. So I think you know, that it is a lot of deep-rooted issues, and not just in government, but really economic inequality that has taken place in Anaheim for a very long time. And I'll share this last part is, we really want to challenge the city's notion that if they continue to subsidize large corporations in Anaheim, somehow, some way, they believe that it trickles down to a better quality of life to residents. And we want to challenge that notion, because we believe that that is a false notion that has not worked and that will not work and continue in the city of Anaheim.
For those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Eli Flores. He's the executive director of Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development, OCORD, shorthand. And so let's go into the sector of labor that are the gig workers, the app workers. There's different ways of doing that, expressing it, and their employ, and you're conducting you're directing some attention to that. And there's OCORD's tweeted out a recent publication about the lot of the gig workers, where the workplace is, they're subjected to, it's sliding scale from verbal abuse to homicide, and those homicides are overrepresented with gig workers of color. So how are you now, are you using that as an example of, about, this is one way we're not seeing a trickle down of subsidies to corporations in the Anaheim area? Is that mean, are you just, are putting that out? Because everybody's thinking, you know, the gig worker is doing, making life easier for everybody else, but the gig worker's life is not at all easy. So is that something are you taking that up with this discussion with the city and subsidizing corporations?
Yeah, we are in solidarity with the gig workers, right? And because, you know, ultimately these are folks from our communities, right? A large majority of the gig workers are people of color. And if you look at the research that was put out and on sort of like connecting and understanding like the connection between people of color and those who were murdered, in 2022 alone, there was at least 31 at base workers who were murdered, right? And they were primarily people of color. And so we know that this is affecting our communities directly. There is a safety issue here, but beyond just a safety issue, there is an economic justice issue here. We don't feel that the gig workers are being compensated as they should be. We believe that there is escalating safety crisis among the workers, and the companies need to do more to be able to protect these workers. I think for us is standing in solidarity with them. There are workers that are in Orange County as well. And so we want to make sure that there are protected workers and folks that are able to still do their job. And for the most part, gig workers are some of the primary ways a lot of our communities are able to be mobile, right? Those who do not have cars. And so we want to stand in solidarity with the gig workers.
So are there particular things you're finding are helpful, and maybe what patrons can be doing to add leverage here to gig workers' support?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's obviously there are state level and even federal level policies that could be put into place to be able to create, I think, more safety for gig workers, but also the classification of the gig worker, right?
Exactly.
I think that's been an issue. That's been an ongoing issue within those companies, with how these workers are classified. And if you classify them as contractors, well, then they're limited on what kind of benefits they can receive, right? They're limited on what kind of protections they can receive being in that company. So I think classification is one of those things that they continue to try to challenge, and gig workers want to be classified differently. And so I think that is part of the issue as well, where the classification of the gig worker. And so, but I did want to mention,
yes,
if it's okay to throw this in here, but there is a National Day of Action taking place, I think, for any of your listeners who want to do something about it. Thursday, May 4th, it is a National Day of Action. Uber and Lyft drivers around the country will hold a National Day of Action to call Uber to raise wages, stop unfair terminations, and create safer conditions for drivers. And so there will be some virtual and in-person activities taking place across the country, in New York, Chicago, Denver, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles as well. There will be a lot of tweets going out, social media posts going out. If you want more information, follow at Accord, and we'll share some of that as well. But if you want to stand in solidarity with these workers, if you have a family member, a friend who is a gig worker, this is a great opportunity for you to get involved on May 4th, even from your home. You can tweet, you can put a social media post in solidarity, and I think that is a great opportunity for us to support those gig workers.
Okay. So, and the classification, we had a chance with the proposition level, I believe it was on the 2020 ballot, not 22, correct? And so that's where we saw the influence of the corporations that were able to fund. Well, it was their initiative to undo the California legislation, and it's still moving around in congressional acts for what these gig workers' actual classifications should be. So it's a big lift, and we can see how the Orange County congressional delegation is all over the map with supporting that reclassification. It's not D, reclassification.
Right.
So it's very, very complicated because of the capital available to keep from reclassifying the gig worker. So National Day of Action, May 4th is okay. So the same week as the International Labor Day. So keep that. So I'm just wanting to know, let's give you a chance as we're closing. I know there's so much more to ask, but what can community members do to help? There's when is the next citizenship fair? I always recommend people go and help out in that. There's so much going on there, to the satisfaction of helping and what one learns from applicants. Other events we should know the dates for, and wish list. Let's just do all that in one fell swoop.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you for giving me that platform to do that. So one, I would say, yeah, part of what Accord does is that we reach the more than 184,000 lawful permanent residents that live in Orange County and could become a U.S. citizen today. So for us, that's where a lot of our work and leadership development begins. We work with those folks who can become U.S. citizens, and then we help them to not just register to vote, but become active in the community. So if you are a resident who is eligible to become a U.S. citizen, reach out to us. We would love to support you. But if your family, friends around, spread the word. You can have folks give us a call at 714-621-0919, extension 6. We would love to help you out. If you are someone who is just passionate and wants to help someone become a U.S. citizen, we are also calling on volunteers for our clinics. Right now, we are planning some smaller clinics, but in the fall, probably around the September, October time, we have a mega fair that will be taking place in the city of Anaheim.
At the convention center?
We help 200, 300 people. And so we want to make sure that we have enough volunteers. So please reach out to us, again, to the same number that I provided, which is the 714-621-0919. Other than that, I would say connect with us on social media. We're on Instagram at Accord or tweet at Accord, or Facebook also at Accord. Reach out to us through there. Connect with us. See what's happening. We regularly post updates, repost what we share, be able to amplify the voice of our community through social media. That is another way that residents or your listeners can get involved in the work that we're doing.
And you're the man to ask. The time from initiating the citizenship application to becoming sworn in as a citizen, has that shortened in the now current, under the current administration?
It, in fact, has shortened, and thankfully it has. So there is a, you know, they still give the time frame of about 8 months to 12 months, but we're actually seeing people do a turnaround in about 6 months. So it is becoming faster. The one thing that the pandemic actually did, which was a huge help, was that the same day that residents are going in to do their interviews with agents, that same day they are being sworn in. That is a huge plus for us, because before pre-pandemic, there was a gap of time between the application and between the appointment at the interview and the swearing in. Sometimes there was a lot of months in between that. Now, the same day, they could be sworn in. So, yeah, I would say that it is approximate still about 8 to 12 months, but we are seeing turnarounds of 6 months. Something improving.
So, I'm sorry, that those that are at the Mega Fair this fall, they'll be eligible to, maybe they'll miss the primary, but they will definitely be eligible for the general election 2024.
Most definitely, yes.
Okay.
Think as long as you are able, and you know, for most of our counties, right, you are able to do same day voter registration now. In Orange County, that is the case. So you might go in there as a provisional ballot, but you still will be able to vote. So yes, if you are able to come to the fall, you will be ready for sure by the general. By the general, you'll be ready to vote. And we have a huge general election coming up that we need all of our communities out there voting. And so we will be part of the election process as well, ensuring that our residents understand what's at the ballot, not just at the federal level, but at the local and state level as well, and that we get folks out to vote.
Well, you can see, folks, that Eli has got so much on his plate. It's just really extraordinary. Well, I want to thank you for the time that you've given us this morning and all the heavy lifting going on. Thank you, Eli, for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My guest was Eli Flores, Executive Director of the OCORD, Orange County Communities for Responsible Development. And he has just given us I'll put all the details inside the podcast summary. Some of you missed the numbers and dates. So we'll be right back with Andy Knight, Director of the Labatt South Coast Rep and co-director of this South Coast Repertory's Pacific Playwrights Festival. It's the 25th annual. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Andy Knight. Welcome back to the show. My next guest is Andy Knight. He's director of the lab at South Coast Repertory and a co-director of the South Coast Reps Pacific Playwrights Festival, which I'm saying it's already running now because the world premiere with Coleman 72, which is a part of all this whole process, it started last week, but this Playwrights Festival's officially, it's May 5th through the 7th, and a little bit now about Andy Knight as the literary manager, too, at South Coast Rep. He previously was an assistant and associate producer at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. He completed his Bachelor's of Fine Arts in Musical Theater at Illinois Wesleyan University. And Andy, today we'll talk about this festival, the highly anticipated showcase of new works, part of the theater's play development arm of the lab at South Coast Rep, and one of the largest showcases of new play development in the country. So welcome everybody to Ground Zero for the organizing of it all. Andy comes to us today from his office in Costa Mesa. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so happy to have you on. Thank you. I'm fine. So let's start with, we'll just talk a little institutional goodies first. The mission. Talk about this mission of, it's sort of, there's parties in this dance. There's the talent and there's the audience, and they bring, there's one bringing the creative process and the other sort of the audience kind of providing a feedback loop to keep working that those creative juices. Talk about that mission.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I think that part of the spirit behind the Pacific Playwrights Festival is bringing all those points of view together in the spirit of helping to foster the development of new work. Because as a literary art form, the theater is very specific in that it is meant to be performed live. An important part of the developmental process of a new play is to hear it in front of an audience and to get that feedback, to see how it lives in the air out loud. And so part of the spirit behind the Pacific Playwrights Festival is allowing for that to happen. And it's a very sort of simple presentation with just reading the play at music stands in front of an audience and getting that immediate feedback. And then the parties come in because we want to celebrate that. We want to celebrate the new play process, celebrate the artistry on our stages, and celebrate the audiences that are so wonderful and game and excited to engage with new plays.
Okay. Thank you for that. So it's the 25th anniversary, and the legacy of this special venue opportunity, it's for you were saying in an interview that was posted on the South Coast Rep's website that, you know, you when you were in Chicago, you saw this little pattern here. There's all this stuff getting commissioned out of South Coast Rep in Costa Mesa, Orange County, California. So this is doing a lot of work, this institution at this Playwright Festival. So talk about the legacy.
Yeah, there's an incredible legacy. As you mentioned, you know, this is our 25th festival. So we've been doing this since 1998. And so many incredible plays have come out of this festival, including Lynn Nottage's Intimate Apparel, Lauren Yee's Cambodian Rock Band, David Lindsay Abair's Rabbit Hole have gone through the festival in some iteration before. And it's a real testament to what the festival can be for artists, where it's a time to just come and to work on a play with really no strings attached, with no sort of expectations of you're going to do this to your play or your play is going to be presented in this form. It's to really figure out what that is. And so I think that the spirit of generosity that we try to approach the festival with as an institution does help sort of foster this generative and collaborative spirit among the artists, which then we hope creates some really exciting plays. And I think that the other aspect of that is South Coast Repertory's long-time commissioning program. They have been commissioning plays here at South Coast Repertory for nearly 40 years now, which is a very long time in the regional theater scene. And so by entering into a relationship with a playwright so early in the process, I think it's really yielded some wonderful, wonderful works.
Indeed. And some of those titles I know from where other directors and organizations have carried them. I remember Intimate Apparel was actually produced here at UCI maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And they're amazing. I just have to say, I'm just in awe of that. And so I can't help but use the incubator metaphor because we'll talk about the steps in this 3-day festival. Is that there's everything from the very first readings, and then you have already started these world premieres that started out here. So you've got this whole range. So I don't know if you want to talk about the first day reading. First of it, just the reading, and then the introduction of scripts, and then the collaborations, and all the way, boom, then you've got these two world premieres going on. Talk about that whole range of functions going on.
Yeah, so the festival is 3 days and 7 plays, and 5 of them are staged readings. So those are the plays that are read at music stands in front of the audience of scripts that are very much in process. And then 2 of those plays are world premiere productions, as you mentioned, Coleman 72 by Charlie O and DeVos by Michael Shayan. And so it's a really fun way to see how a play goes from the page to the stage. So both Coleman 72 and DeVos have come out of previous festivals. Coleman 72 we did a reading of in 2021 when we did a digital festival. So we rehearsed it here in person at South Coast Repertory and then filmed it and streamed it for audiences. And then DeVos was in last year's festival as a staged reading. And so coming out of those two processes, those two separate festivals, we were really excited by these plays and excited to provide an opportunity for them to have their next step, which would be the world premiere production. And so there's a lot that goes into that. I mean, certainly with the staged readings themselves, starting with that component, the cast comes together with the director, with the playwright, with the dramaturg, and they meet and they read the play, they discuss the play, they figure out the light ways where if you get this play on its feet at a music stand in front of an audience member, what is the best way to communicate this play with an audience? What is the best way to communicate what is happening in this play? And then they work on that for about 4 days, and then they present it for an audience. So it's actually a very quick process. But it can be a very fruitful process for the playwright during rehearsals. Many of the playwrights are doing a lot of rewriting during rehearsals. And then after they have the chance to hear the play in front of the audience, they certainly continue to do work on the piece once they've received that feedback, once they know where audiences are leaning in, where audiences might be leaning away or might be confused, what's really working, what was surprising, what they thought was not going to work, but like, just really, really, you know, came together quite well. And then when you get into the production processes themselves, you know, that's about now taking that play that's on the page and not just hearing the words out loud, but making it a piece that lives in 3 dimensions. So certainly, once again, the director is very involved in that process. But then you start to incorporate design elements. You start to have those conversations. You start to say, okay, practically, how does this play work? Stage readings have a lot of imagination required, imagination from the cast and the creative team, but also an imagination from an audience to say, oh, I bet it would look like this. In my mind's eye, this is how it would look when it was fully produced. But then when you get to the production process, you're certainly now very much literalizing that and saying, okay, now we actually do have to do it in 3 dimensions. So just how do you do that?
And I just quickly about Coleman 72 that I saw last Friday, how it's when you walk in, it's a pretty spare stage. And it's so amazing how elegantly there's this intimation of the family packed in a vehicle and sort of how they move it around. And that translation into the drama and all that. So it's just all these wonderful pieces. For those of you who just joined us, my guest is Andy Knight, director of the lab at South Coast Rep and co-director of the South Coast Repertory's 25th annual Pacific Playwrights Festival. And it's running May 5th through the 7th. But I still want to say unofficially, it started because of the world premieres that are out now. So this I'm sorry you won't have a chance to say a whole lot about each of the stage readings. They're Dr. Silver, a musical I hope I can play as a pairing to this interview. A little clip from the Dr. Silver's Gone. Let's see. Hope I can do that. Anika Britt and Britt Johnson, Chapters of a Floating Life by Clarence Coo, A Small Man by Noah Gardner, Crassus by Blue Beckford Burrell, Galilee 34 by Eleanor Burgess. So those are that. I don't know if you want to just maybe take one and say, this is what's going on. It's amazing.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about Crassus by Blue Beckford Burrell and A Small Man, which is now has a new title that's part of the new play process.
Okay,
too.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. An exclusive here. It is now called The Staircase by Noah Gardner. And the reason I want to just highlight those two is because they are South Coast Repertory commissions. So those are plays that we've been working on with these playwrights really since their inception, since they were just an idea in for the playwright. And so we're really excited because this is going to be the first time these two plays really have any sort of a public outing.
Wow.
Blues play is a really wonderful and complex and very sort of scary ghost story with some really sort of lovely use of language and imagery. And Noah's play is an intimate family story set in Hawaii. Also, just Noah's a real expert with language. And so just being able to listen to those two plays, I think, will be a real treat for audiences because they're very much about the words.
And Andy, here's where I show what little I know about everything. So it's the playwright that does this reading this week?
The playwrights are involved, yes.
But who's doing the reading?
The readings themselves are performed by actors.
But they are the actors, and the playwright is somewhere nearby.
Yeah, the playwright's usually watching in the audience.
Are they looking more in the forward or looking sideways and backward? Where do they look?
It depends. Usually, sometimes all directions.
Wow. Okay. This is so exciting, folks. So that's anything more you want to say before we talk about then the playwrights panel? That's on the house that people can hear all the playwrights together. But more about the readings?
I would say that if you can come and see them all, I would definitely do that. Part of how we curate the festival, too, is we want to create a 7-play, 3-day experience that if you're an audience member, you can come see a real disparate lineup of work. And so mm-hmm. you're really, nothing is going to be too much alike. And so you're always going to be coming in and having a very different experience with each reading or production you come see.
So like instead of speed dating, speed patroning, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Something, it just occurs to me. So, you know, Annie, what do you want audiences to take away from this year?
You know, we want audiences to take away how important new work is and what it means to build a play. I think that part of the festival is a real insider look for audiences. These are all plays that are at different steps of their processes. And so having that sort of backstage view is illuminating for audiences. And also, I think that what we also want audiences to take away from this experience is that no two plays are alike, no two experiences are alike, and sometimes as audience members, we think we know what we like, but we don't. We don't until we get there. And so it's about taking a chance, and so we want to foster an adventuresome spirit in audiences.
I'm so glad you said that, because as I'm saying over and over again is I've never seen as many plays as I have in the last, let's say, 6-7 years. And it's exactly right. We don't know what we like. And I don't know until the last line is uttered in a play. That'll tell me at the very end, oh, you really did like this. You really bought into all that. So that is such a great service, the cultural service you render to the community. So how do you know that a piece is successful as a production?
That's an interesting question. I think that it's, first of all, that's a very hard thing to gauge because, once again, art is subjective. And so every piece functions differently for an audience. And I think that the thing that's important is very often we can go off of collective experiences of audiences where, gosh, you know, this is really galvanizing the groups of people that are coming to see it, and they're all really responding positively to the piece. And then sometimes you have audiences that are quieter at the plays, and, you know, you say, oh, you know, is this production not doing as well? But I think that sometimes we forget about the individual, that this play may not speak to me, but, you know, there is someone in the audience that this play is really speaking to. And if it is reaching that one person, that is a success. And so it's hard to gauge, you know, how successful a piece is when you're looking at metrics, like this one was more successful than this other one. Although I will say that there is the rarer experience where just really everyone is loving it. Everyone is loving it for different reasons. And you can feel that in the audience. You can feel that electricity.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious how Coleman 72 felt in the reading. And it was a massive effect that it had on me. I'm just going to leave it at that, because I'm here to boost sales. Let's just face it. I want people to show up to all of these aspects of the festival and experience that. So, yeah, and as you said, everybody's gonna take that intergenerational Korean theme very differently in Coleman 72. And I am looking forward to the matinee of Abaz in coming up here, and he'll be on, folks. We'll have Michael Cheyenn on next week, so in the same slot Andy's in right now. So the details, I'm going to post them in the podcast summary, but I don't know if you want to give any more details about the May 5 through 7 events.
Come all weekend. Those are the details that I have, and you can find tickets on our website or by calling our box office, which I'm sure you'll share with listeners. But you know, if you've never been to a new play festival, I think it's the perfect time to start.
Yes, it's scr.org. Just keep that on your screensaver or somewhere, folks, and then you can drop right in there. There's a big panel for the Pacific Playwrights Festival for people to scroll through and find out what's going on. And the playwrights panel, that I gave it a glancing reference, but what's it like when they're all together? You said they're such disparate plays. So how do they all manage to talk in 1 hour together?
We have a really great moderator, SCR's Artistic and Audience Engagement Associate, H. Adam Harris, who's really, really skilled at sort of organizing a space together so everyone does get a chance to talk a little bit about their process and how they build plays, and the way that he makes sort of a warm-spirited room helps that playwrights panel, which lasts an hour, feel like 2 minutes, but 2 minutes where everyone gets to talk.
Oh, wow. A tall order. Well, Andy, I want to thank you for being on Ask a Leader today. This has been a real treat, and the treat will pick up where we're leaving off here, right there in Costa Mesa at the Sagerstrom Performing Arts Center, where South Coast Rep is housed.
Thank you.
My guest was Andy Knight, director of the lab at South Coast Rep and a co-director of the South Coast Repertory's 25th Annual Playwrights Festival, running, as we said, May 5th through the 7th. But run to those two world premieres continuing through the end of the month. Well, this is my wrap. Next week, my guests include Virginia Parks, UCI Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy, on how the closure of a Marathon refinery affected its displaced workers. As well, we'll continue coverage, as I said, with South Coast Rep, with Michael Cheyenn, playwright and performer of the world premiere Abaz. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.